Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts. Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast which brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas.
Last year, Ireland voted to get rid of its blasphemy laws and most applauded the new right to offend the Catholic Church.
This week, our speakers debate the right to offend.
We also expect our press and our comedians to be viciously critical or even offensive to our leaders. Yet to avoid giving offence, student campuses are introducing no platforming and safe spaces.
Should we seek to eradicate offence to create a more tolerant and equal society? Or is offence vital to freedom and a critical means to containing the powerful? Taking this on, we have author of Women vs. Feminism and associate editor of the political magazine Spiked, Joanna Williams, respected pundit who writes for the I, International Business Times and The New European, Yasmin Alibi Brown, and award-winning journalist and broadcaster who sits on the board for the Index of Censorship, David Aronovich. Before we begin, please do also be aware that due to the nature of this debate, this podcast does contain some language that listeners may find offensive. Back now to Roger Bolton, who hosts this week's episode.
Joanna.
So, I think the right to be offensive is absolutely vital in a society that purports to uphold a belief in free speech. For one thing, we don't need the right to free speech for what's inoffensive. We can be as bland and as boring as we like, and nobody's ever going to challenge us. We only need the right to be the right to free speech, and it becomes meaningful and important when we're going to say things that might upset other people. My second argument is that free speech, and most importantly, the right to be offensive, is necessary for society to advance. If you think about all the major leaps forward we've made as a society, whether we're talking about abolishing slavery, universal suffrage, gay marriage, anything you can think of, evolution, all of these ideas have grossly offended some sections of society. And if we didn't have the right to offend, we wouldn't have been able to argue for those causes, which I think we would all agree now are hugely progressive and really important. We needed to be able to offend to make the case for those things. The final point I'd make, and this is where I'm so sorry, Yasmin, but I just don't know why you would be here today if you think words can't change people's
views. It's called debate.
Oh, yes, yes, exactly. Debate's so important to try and change people's minds, to change people's views.
Not ideologues.
Because words are important, words are very important indeed, because however much we might wish it were otherwise, we can't just magic bad ideas away. And there are an awful lot of bad ideas out there in the world, and we need debate, we need the right to be offensive, we need free speech to be able to challenge those bad ideas.
Yasmin, your outline.
I think bad ideas or good ideas, yes, require words and bravery. But I don't think there is a duty on free speeches to offend. And that's the problem. People think they're being awfully brave when they pick on certain groups and not on others and deliberately set out to offend them. I have four letters from four wannabe novelists who sought from me a comment to suggest that they should have the fatwa because their sales would go up. I don't think there's a duty to offend. There is a right.
Are you going to name them?
They're unknown novelists who wanted a fatwa. I can give you the list afterwards. So I think there is civilized discourse. I think absolutely I agree with you that difficult ideas need to be argued for. But ideologues and people who are set in their ways, it's a waste of my time and theirs. But also, let me just quote somebody I really admire, Deborah Orr, who says, who really thinks the right to offend is inalienable? Who believes that some hideous error was made when it became untenable to put up notices in your pub saying no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. Who thinks those were better times? And that's where I'm coming from. There's a limit. There are people who set out to offend certain groups of people, and there are people who are brave and who are arguing in very difficult circumstances. There are issues that are very difficult to argue without being threatened and being and that does cause upset. But my problem is that free speech warriors now think it's their duty to demean and insult and dehumanize groups of people, often those who are powerless. And I can't go with that.
David.
I think I'm going to begin by quarreling, which is a really bad thing to do with the title of the session. But only in this sense. I don't really think that offence is the big question here. It is for some people, and quite often, and in fact we've just heard an example of it, when people use the term offence, they actually mean something different, which is they mean, are there things that people can do, can say, which are dangerous for other people? And if there, we believe there are, what are is our ability, if we have it, to stop them a worse danger in the round than the thing that they are saying? And I think that's really what the debate about free speech is about. So let me give an obvious example which we could come down to, the problem of hate speech. And by the way, what we can see on this freedom of speech question is a kind of pendulum which was swinging very much in favour of free speech in almost every regard, but I'm talking about the democratic West, largely until the advent of social media about a decade ago. And after that, we've been in a perpetual war about what should be permitted and what shouldn't be permitted because of the ability, effectively, of anybody and everybody to publish an expression and have it seen by everybody. Anyway, that's what I think I should leave by saying at the moment.
Should we just look at a couple of things that underline this? Let's start by the suggestion is that certain people need protecting, not us, but there's an argument people need protecting. Supposing that there's a disabled person out there and I call them a spastic. Now, I would have used that term 40 years ago. Now it's offensive if I use the word nigger, which some people said I shouldn't use at all. The assumption is that there are people out there so offended and so vulnerable to offence that they need to be protected. Now, is that the case? And in which case is their need to be protected so great that the rest of us should moderate what we say? Joanna, can you think of cases where simply because of how much a small section of society would be hurt, we should not say something?
No, I can't. And as I'm a free speech absolutist. I mean, I'll be absolutely clear about this. I am a free speech absolutist. But I think the point you're making really illustrates for me one of the reasons why I am a free speech absolutist, because I think you actually bring prejudice back in through the back door when you start defining limits to free speech. So you start saying some groups of people are more sensitive, are less easy to cope with debate, are just more vulnerable than others. So we start
making
these assumptions.
So those people who are going to be genuinely hurt, you say to them, it's too bad, it's in the greater good.
I think the corollary of
this... No, are you saying that? That they just have to put up with it for the greater good?
Well, no, I'm not actually, because I think if I heard anybody using the words that you used, I would argue back against them. I would say, no, can you not use these words?
Yeah, and they're probably going to pay no attention. And the question, the implicit question here is, should we be taking action to stop the expression, either of those views of that language, because there may be people who would be hurt? And you're saying, I think you must be saying, there may be people who would be hurt, but there's a larger issue.
I am saying that, but I'm not saying, I am saying, yes, there's a larger issue. You're absolutely right. I'm saying people might be hurt, but there's a larger issue, and the larger issue is free speech. But I'm also not saying that everybody in the world has to turn into this kind of really tough individual and just take it all on the chin, and we should all go around throwing the most offensive insults at the most vulnerable people in society and just expect them to kind of lap it up in the name of free speech. I'm saying society is a collective, and as a collective, if we see people saying things we disagree with, we can argue back against them. We can say, I disagree with what you've said. We can stick up for other people. And I think that's solidarity, where we act collectively to defend and to stick up for people, is really important. And actually,
hate speech legislation
takes away our ability to act in solidarity with others.
Well, I'll come to legislation later, but David, can we make a distinction between ideas and facts? Can we say, and I ask you as a Jew this question, Holocaust denial versus, if you like, criticism of Jews more generally, or Israel? Is there a way you could disagree where you say society has an obligation to say these facts exist? Opinions about the causes are fine, but the facts can't be denied. I'm thinking back to a situation where, for example, I understand some Japanese schools, history books, don't refer to Manchuria and what the Japanese did in Manchuria. So you don't know the appalling things that happened and elsewhere. So can you make that distinction?
Well, it's an interesting that you should put that example at the end, because that's quite a good example, if you like, of malign no-platforming, isn't it? What they've decided is that it's inconvenient for their version of society to have an account of Manchuria in their books. In the same way, the Germans decided that so appalling for them was the idea of Holocaust denial that they would actually make it illegal. And indeed, David Irving, the author, actually served some time in Chokie in Austria because they have the similar Holocaust denial laws. We don't have them in Britain. You can sell books and you can go on platforms saying that you think the Holocaust is a hoax.
And are you happy that, I'm just trying to make this distinction between opinion and fact. Do you think that that's irrelevant in a sense? You should allow people to challenge anything, even if you think the factual basis is demonstrably wrong.
Now, this now comes to the question of what appears where and who gives it sanction in what kind of a way. So, in principle, do I think it should be banned and made illegal? No. Should it be available to people who want to find it? Yes. Should you argue against it at all levels? Yes. Should you put a programme on the BBC advocating Holocaust denial? No, because it's a-factual. The BBC faced a huge problem when it came to how it was going to talk about and describe climate change. It was a classic example. One of the things it decided to do after a lot of argument was it could not give equal weight to people who said climate change wasn't a real thing to people who said that climate change was a real thing, because that was effectively the scientific consensus.
Also slightly qualified that human beings had made a very significant contribution to climate change was the specific.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But funnily enough, nowadays when we talk about climate change, that's what most people assume you're talking about. Mm. But I take your point.
But are we arguing then with? I mean, but the problem you face is that, as you correctly say, John, at the beginning, science often advances by the lone voice, questioning the consensus and so on. But that's an idea, and I was trying to see whether, as a fact, we can make that distinction. Yasmin, can you see, is that a reasonable distinction to even consider? You consider banning certain ideas, the expression of certain ideas, but you try and protect above everything the factual basis as far as possible.
Well, I want to go back to what Joanna said. I think that shows a really quite worrying inability to understand.
Could you just address the point I made before?
Because it's really important.
When I'm sure it is, but just...
somebody calls me a packy, it isn't... it makes no difference if somebody else defends me. Because the wound, that sense of feeling utterly alone and diminished, remains with you for a long time. This is what people don't understand. I wanted to reply to that in particular, but you're asking me a specific question. I think ideas we think we're very free-minded and open about, are controlled. And David's given a very good example. The BBC could not have a program on Holocaust denial. But we have Prevent. We have a whole government policy, right? Which is saying you cannot have ideas of Islamic extremism brought to university to be discussed. This is part of the regulation. I'm a professor at Middlesex. We are told to look out for such debates. I don't agree with that, but I can see why they're doing it.
But can I just pick up two points with you, if I may. One is, you said, Joanna, I'm sure didn't mean to, but offended you or didn't understand the nature of the offence you feel when you're called a packy.
I think offence is the wrong word.
Hurt. But does that mean, because you are hurt by that, you would stop people saying it?
Yes. I don't want people to say nigger. How many people here feel the need to say nigger? Please put your hand up. You would. One out of how many? Yeah? No, I don't want to be called packy. I don't want words lead to places. Rwanda, Bosnia. How many more examples do you need?
All right, Joanna, come quickly.
Thank you. Oh, I just want to ask Yasmin. Yasmin, who made you God to decide who can and can't say particular things? Well, it is you who's sitting here now saying we can't say this, we can't say that. But I would just add another argument.
Hold on, you asked her a question.
Okay, at risk of putting words in your mouth, another argument is the reason why I would want the word nigger out there, even though it's not a word I would like to use myself, is because if people think that, I want to know it. You can't wish it away. You can't wish racism away.
Yeah, but
if
the
people
argument
have
of that
racist
is...
attitudes, I want them out there. I want to know who these people are so they can be argued against.
If you we never just say, get rid of
can't
my
say
argument.
This, you drive it underground.
No, I don't care about your arguments. I care about how we feel in the public space. I do not want women called tarts, and I do not want girls insulted with words. I do not want to be called packy. It's my right to be.
But that's not the argument. It's not what you want. The argument is not what you want, but whether it should be banned.
I think it has disappeared from the public space. People do not use the word nigger. People, when they use the word packy, it is a weapon. And I was called it just the other day.
But hold on.
Ban it in the sense that society agrees we shouldn't use it.
Well,
there's no law against it.
Okay, let's move on now to the issue of no platforming, which is a logical extension in some ways of that. You've been no platform, haven't you?
Attempted.
why were they trying to no platform you?
So I've written things critical of the Me Too movement, and I also wrote, and I have to stress, not critical of transgender individuals, but critical of the transgender movement, particularly as it seems to be active in relation to children. And because I made those criticisms, I was then subject to a petition when I was about to do a debate at King's College London, which incidentally had nothing to do with gender in any way, shape or form, was to do with academic freedom. The petition accused me of denying the right of women and trans people to exist, dismissing entire demographics, of putting people at risk of violence and violent attacks. It was incredibly melodramatic stuff. The kind of irony is, after this petition was circulated, gathered hundreds of signatures, the people at King's College took the decision very bravely, and I'm really, really pleased to say, to let the event go ahead. Not one of the people who signed the petition came along. I really hoped they would. I was really keen to hear what they had to say. I, unlike Yasmin, I really do believe in debate. I wanted to be able to argue back against them. More importantly, I wanted them to be able to argue back against me, but by not showing up, they not only did I not have that opportunity, they didn't have that opportunity either. Interestingly,
but they got their headlines.
No, but interestingly, I just add, sorry, the reason why they didn't show up was because the Israeli ambassador was speaking elsewhere at the university, and they decided it was far more important to go and protest him than to protest me.
David, to what extent do you think when no platforming comes up, we should look at the politics of this? To what extent do you think what is going on is people are trying to, as it were, capture the language so that they control the debate to a degree? And so we should see this in part as an issue of principle, but partly as a political tactic.
And when I was a student politician many, many, many years ago, when the discussion about no platforming in a way first began, and then the left presented it as being like this, actual fascists, people who kind of, you know, march around with uniforms, etc., are outside the normal weft of politics, unsusceptible to debate. Funny, really, because it comes back to what Yasmin was saying when she said she wouldn't debate Hitler. Of course, Hitler famously didn't debate anybody. I don't know what history would have looked like if he had, but famously he didn't. He was a kind of no-platform par excellence. In the end, he was the ultimate no-platformer, really. So the idea was extremely limited. But essentially, when I thought about it later, and then it's been extended, really, and the issue of offence has extended it yet further, because instead of it being a judgment about the efficacy of a certain type of politics taking over, it becomes a judgment about the subjective feelings of people. And it is incredibly problematic to ban things on the basis of people's subjective feelings, because people have different subjective feelings.
It's
the transgender thing, incidentally, it illustrates that very well.
It's an attempt to shut down the debate, in your view.
And there's no question about it. And not only that, but if you think about it, it has another thing. The people who argue that there should be no platform, not for offence reasons, but for reasons of, let's say, normalising certain types of speech is a very common expression now, and never worried that it might affect them. Never. It's not that they're not worried they might become fascists as a result of it. They're worried that other people will become fascists as a result of it. In other words, these other people they're making a judgment are the people who will be affected by this type of speech and transformed.
So is there anybody? I mean, supposing David Irving came back and said, I want to speak here and I want to make the case, as I have in the past, that the concentration camps either didn't exist or
whatever. What happens in the film Denial?
Yeah.
What happens? He's played by Timothy Spall, and at certain stages he gives a kind of creepily good impression of what he's saying, and then he's taken apart.
Partly because of the brilliance of the witnesses and the brilliance of the QC. But here we're talking about the principle of platforming when such brilliance and may not be available to deconstruct what he's saying. Would you no platform David Irving?
No, I wouldn't no platform David Irving, but I would very much want to see a proper contested debate if you were to have somebody like that involved, or I would want people to understand what was at stake with it. So I might issue, if I try to, I might issue YouTube connections to Denial.
So it's a qualified, in a sense, it's a qualified platform. Well, it's a platform where you have built in certain necessary constraints.
Roger, here's the problem. The same rights that give me the right to be sitting up here saying what I'm saying now are the same rights that I am giving to David Irving. Those rights applying to Irving are also the rights applying to me.
Yeah, but rights have to have responsibilities. And do you say...
No, they don't.
You don't?
No, they
so
don't.
So where do the rights come
from?
No,
the idea that rights have to have responsibilities is just not true.
All right, okay.
We want people to take responsibility. It's a fair thing in a fair society to ask, but rights exist independent of responsibility.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Bringing that back, Joan.
Quick point on no platforming in universities in particular, but in broader society too. It always backfires. If somebody no platforms me, I'm like, yeah, great. A, I don't need to go to the trouble of making a speech, of turning up, of actually talking to people. B, I get a million times more publicity. If a speech goes ahead, only the few people in the room hear what I have to say. If I get no platformed, wow, it's going to be in every newspaper. And C, the ideas and the person take on a lure of kind of forbidden fruit. It becomes something more exciting among certain sections of the population, but you're going to have to take my word on this, more enticing. They go to YouTube deliberately to look it up. This must be something really exciting because it's been banned, because it's been no platformed. So no platforming is the biggest, quickest, easiest way to shoot yourself in the foot if it's an idea that you don't like. I'm not suggesting for one second any individual, just grow a thick skin and suck it up. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying in order to have political solidarity, we need these bad ideas out there so we can argue against them. So if I hear hear somebody making an anti-Semitic remark, which you do more frequently, and I agree, is absolutely shocking and appalling, I want to be able to argue against that. I don't want it driven underground. I don't want it to seem more attractive for whatever perverse reason people would see it as more attractive. I don't want to hand power to other people to decide what I can and can't hear. I want anti-Semitism out there so it can be absolutely argued against.
You do not argue against deep prejudices. What an arrogant position you're taking, that you have the power to argue and save us from ourselves. It is not possible to understand the feelings. We're talking here about feeling utterly. I was assaulted on Thursday, physically assaulted, these things you see on me, all right? The thing that is I'm left with is, why? Why did he do this? What? It's the emotional thing, and you do
but
not
Yasmin,
argue.
But Yasmin,
you
Hussein,
cannot argue
lots,
about
Yasmin,
that.
I don't want to downplay it. There are lots of pain, but there are so many people, maybe in this room, who could talk about being assaulted, maybe particularly women. What we've got to say is that a sufficient reason for significantly restricting freedom of speech? And I'm not quite sure I know your position on this.
I'm not an absolutist. I believe that freedom of speech always, and everybody has a red line, even Spiked. I have looked at Spiked and I argue with Brendan O'Neill, their star, almost every other week. They have not crossed certain lines. They have not said anything on their sites that they know would upset, for example, British Jewish people.
But that's because we're not careful. Anti-Semitic.
They're very, very careful. There's a lot of anti-Muslim stuff, but there really isn't. And what I want to say is this, that we could not survive as a society if we all became freedom of speech absolutists. Or in the public space, restraint and care and kindness is all I'm saying. We need to be kinder and understand.
Yeah, but everybody
but
would
I'm
agree
not
with
talking
the
about the law.
The question we're arguing is whether that and how that needs to be underpinned. Let's move on to the last question, if I may, which was whether outlawing offence would create a more tolerant society. And David, I want to put you a couple of points in a very interesting article. Written on Tuesday in The Independent by somebody called Yasmin Alibi Brown.
I newspaper, not Independent.
Independent
sacked me.
Anyway, this really interesting article says this, that last week on Radio 4, I argued with the Labour MP who is pushing to institutionalise a particular definition of Islamophobia. Muslims dear to me and unimpeachable egalitarians are driving this campaign. And she's opposed to that. She also says, but for the record, I'm also against the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism. Such designations are both dubious and counterproductive. Before I come to you, Yasmin, can I ask David specifically about the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism? Would you support that, or do you think it does any good at all?
You're a clever bugger, Roger. You get me just at the sweet spot. Because the truth is, although I might not want to join a political party that didn't endorse this as their position, I don't like these definitions. I don't like either of these definitions. There are bits of the anti-Semitic definition that I don't agree with. I just don't agree that per se, calling the Israeli government, although I regard it as a ridiculous hyperbole, Nazi-like, is itself anti-Semitic. I simply don't agree with it intellectually. And yet that's partially in the definition. I understand the reason why it's in the definition. The same reason that Yasmin talks about in the definition of Islamophobia, things fall into the context of that definition, which simply do not belong there. Now, the question about whether or not and under what circumstances you require a definition, I mean, these are not legal definitions, by the way. No. You couldn't prosecute anybody on the basis of these definitions. And the law sets quite a substantial test for freedom of speech, which by and large is things like incitement to hatred. However, worryingly, there has been a widening of interpretation. I'll give you just a little example. In 2012, I'm a Tottenham Hotspur supporter, a guy called Fabrice Mwamba was playing for Bolton and collapsed on the pitch. And we were standing there as we thought the man was dying and he was saved. An idiot went on Twitter and said, "Whoa, good, I hope he dies, etc. And who cares, you know, etc." And then got into an argument with people on Twitter. This guy was a guy who was drunk and in his 20s. He went to court and was actually given a prison sentence because the judge effectively said that what he'd done had said was outraging the public, the public sense. I did not even know until that point there was such an offence of outraging the public sense. In other words, somebody takes an idea of what it is that the public doesn't like as a kind of group and says you can go to prison for that. Those sorts of definitions and those kind of approaches worry me significantly, not because I care about this particular guy, although I did feel a little bit sorry for him, but because it could be any of us. Who decides, etc.? Well, of course, politicians decide, and the politicians will decide based on what the public may decide. But we know that in different countries, that bar is set in different places, and in different places, we could fall under that bar.
But to what extent do you think also with anti-Semitism? I mean, one of the things that seems remarkable to me is that, you know, the long-running argument about Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party and whether they're anti-Semitic, whatever. There has not been on the public service broadcaster a proper programme which asks the simple question is, what constitutes anti-Semitism? And what language can we use about the state of Israel, which is not anti-Semitic and legitimately allows one to debate the arguments? So therefore, you have these allegations going back and forward and a reluctance to define it, which I think is a rather strange occurrence. So people are using terms which they don't fully understand.
And that's true, Roger, but it may be unresolvable in some ways. Let me take an example. A lot of Jews feel, and for understandable reasons, that if the sole country which you attach these, your hostility to, in terms of certain behaviours, is Israel, they feel got at automatically because that is the only Jewish state. There are lots and lots of Muslim states. There are states that call themselves overtly Muslim and so on. And yet you choose to get this one now.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to argue is that because it's such a sensitive subject, the terms are used, but the debate isn't held because liberals hold back in some ways and don't want to be associated with it. So we've got actually quite an amorphous, unexplored area here in which people don't want to go into it because it's so dangerous. But let's discuss the question of, with you, Yasmin, of why, just a little more detail, why you don't want this particular definition of Islamophobia adopted.
Well, I think both definitions, and David's eloquently dealt with some of the arguments. What I said is it's self-defeating because what it's done, it's privatized, it's a separatist movement, if you like, of anti-racism. Anti-racism is a lifelong battle many of us have had to fight. And the way we got anywhere is through alliances, through my understanding, your anti-Semitism, you understanding what black men go through even to this day, the most discriminated against group. And it's through those alliances. So once you begin to use, I never use the word Islamophobia, because it seems to me even the word indicates a separatism from anti-racism. So it defeats our alliances, our empathies for each other.
But what about prejudice against Islam, which people hold often knowing nothing about Islam? Why is saying they are prejudiced against Islam better than saying they're Islamophobic?
Because I think, as I explained, Islamophobic, also phobic indicates a kind of fear. I don't think it is a fear. Some of it is quite calculated. Muslims, it's not Islam which is discriminated against, because that's an idea, that's a faith. It's Muslims, right? And we need not to be so self-regarding and lock ourselves into this inner circle.
So if somebody said Muslimophobia and invented that word, would that be more
acceptable?
No,
we don't need another word. Racism will do. Racism will do. There's one word. Racism is all we need.
But hold on. It won't do because all Muslims are not of one particular race.
Yeah, but ethnicity, it covers racism.
It doesn't, and Muslims are not one ethnic group. That's a problem.
It's my view that Islamophobia is the wrong word for what's going on, because it's not against us as a Muslim. When I'm called a Paki, most of the time I'm called a Paki. Okay? What are they talking about? My skin colour? My non-existent relationship with Pakistan? Or my faith? I don't know. We have no research to show whether white Bosnian Muslims in our country suffer this thing called Islamophobia. We don't know. We need to be tackling prejudice, discrimination for all those who experience it. Part of progress is to be self-critical and to be criticised honestly and fairly. And I don't want people from my communities, there isn't a single community, to get so locked in a definition that we don't look at the misogyny, for example, that is a serious problem, or the homophobia, which is a serious problem. So those are my arguments.
We're going to come to the end. And I'm afraid, Yasmin, that has to be your closing remarks. Come to Joanna now, and then finally to David, if I may, because we're running out of time. I'm sorry about that. Joanna.
Thank you. I didn't think it was possible, but I've actually found something that I agree with you on, Yasmin. I think that phobia has a very specific meaning in terms of fear, deep-rooted fear. And I think one of the problems that we face in relation to free speech nowadays, and it's brought about because we live in this outrage culture where we kind of enjoy at some level being outraged and being able to tell people how offended we are, is we have this linguistic inflation where we attach phobia onto nearly everything. I am going to say something which will no doubt make me incredibly unpopular, even more unpopular perhaps than I am already. I voted Leave in the referendum 3 years ago. For that, I've been called a Nazi, a fascist, racist, xenophobic, you know, a gammon. You name the insults that have been hurled at me. There's no insult you can't imagine that hasn't been hurled at me. I obviously would deny that I am any of those things. But as soon as you start throwing around those labels, it makes people think twice about speaking out. It makes people think twice about expressing their views. Nobody wants to say, you know, yes, I'm xenophobic or racist, or you know, and if voting Leave to leave the EU on democratic grounds is enough to have those insults hurled at you, it does make people think twice about expressing their views. I think also it's really dangerous territory, because if everybody who voted Leave is a xenophobic, racist, fascist, Nazi, where on earth do we go linguistically when we do encounter xenophobic, racist, fascist, Nazis? We've used up the language. We haven't got words left to accurately define them. Just final point, as associate editor of Spiked, I want to thank Yasmin for saying that we're not anti-Semitic. We're not. We're not anti-Muslim either, because believe it or not, it is possible to be pro-free speech without being anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim. The two do not have to go hand in hand. You can be very, very pro-free speech. You can be a free speech absolutist. It does not mean you are anti-Semitic or racist.
I would question that.
Have to later. David, we clearly have not got a majority, shall we say, for no platforming here. I don't think we've got a majority for anything other than an intense suspicion of controlling free speech, but a real concern about those who are particularly hurt by some examples of it. Can you give us any constructive way forward? What would you suggest?
Well, I want to say this thing about this kind of, you know, how appallingly treated leavers have been, because this is something which is almost kind of robotically programmed into anybody from Spike to tell you at any meeting you go to, they say this, and it's driving me nuts. It would also help if you didn't characterise people with Remainers as sneering metropolitan liberals living in a London bubble who are all rich.
Right. I think on that constructive note of agreement, on your behalf, let me thank the panel. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Philosophy for Our Times. The podcast is brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. For more on the question of freedom, then please do explore our whole archive of Philosophy for Our Times episodes. Why not have a listen to episode 36 on the limits of freedom, which looks at whether constraining freedom could actually be the key to our freedom in helping us make choices. As ever, please do subscribe to the podcast, tell anyone you know that might be interested, do head over to iTunes, give us a rating or review, and of course, tune in next week for more debates and talks from the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas.